Это трагический день в истории российской дипломатии. Сегодня в Анкаре.
Совершенное преступление – это, безусловно, провокация, направленная на срыв нормализации российско-турецких отношений.
Это особый человек, особого вклада.
Трагедия заставляет всех нас еще решительно бороться с терроризмом.
Мы должны знать, кто направлял руку убийцы.
It's easy to look at 2016 as the year Putin won. In many ways, the past year handed the Kremlin leader a perfect storm. Western angst and malaise from the financial, euro, and migrant crises crested and dovetailed with a concerted Russian campaign to undermine Western institutions. 2016 was also the year that Western fatigue with Middle East interventions allowed Moscow to take the lead role in Syria, undermine the West's interests, and prop up Bashar al-Assad, making Russia the region's dominant power. But as this week's assassination of Russia's ambassador in Ankara illustrates, victory often comes with a heavy price and can carry within it the seeds of defeat. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome to the last podcast of the year, Mark. It's just the two of us today.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's start with a basic issue. It's becoming pretty fashionable to say this is the year Putin won. Max Trudolubov had a piece on his blog about that this week. And it's easy to come to that conclusion. So what do you think? Did he win? Is he winning?
I don't really think so. I mean, or put it another way, God spare Russia from many more such victories. Because my basic point is precisely that although there's a whole array of ways in which he seems to be very much on the move forward, nonetheless, they will carry with them precisely these terrible costs, and in fact likely to be increasing costs, which means that if we really want to see 2016 as the year that Putin won, in some ways 2017 is the year in which the price tag will start to become obvious.
Well, in a piece in Open Democracy this week, a very good piece, you kind of played on that theme. You cite the assassination of Andrei Karlov in Ankara as an example of how Russia could be about to face some blowback, that great intelligence term for the unintended adverse consequences of political actions. I made a similar argument in the Daily Vertical, as did Leonid Bershitsky in Bloomberg and Vladimir Frolov in Republik Rus. So it seems like a lot of us are thinking alike on this. The basic contours of the argument are that by backing Assad in Iran and Syria, Russia's turned itself into the enemy of Sunni Muslims, and in the process replaced the United States as public enemy number one in the Middle East. But you take the blowback argument a little bit further, making the case that Russia will face this in other areas where it appears to be winning right now. Let's start with Syria and the Middle East and then move on to some of the others. Was the Karlov assassination a harbinger of blowback, do you think?
Well, it may or may not be. We don't know about individual cases. But on the other hand, what is clear is precisely that Russia has pretty firmly embedded itself within the difficult and dangerous politics of the Middle East. I mean, whether it's on the verge of replacing the United States as the sort of the greatest Satan, we don't know.
Frolov said how Russia replaced America as public enemy number one in the Middle East.
It may or may not be. But the point is this, look. When Putin initially deployed his forces into Syria, it was meant to be for a very short and very, very specific mission. And they did that, one has to say, actually, with surprising alacrity and efficiency. And then Putin talked about actually withdrawing his forces, and he seems to actually then wavered. Mm-hmm. Some people think, oh, well, it was maybe just a political measure. Certainly people I've spoken to in Moscow suggest that no, it was definitely that there was a decision made to actually change the idea. Mm-hmm. Now, we see that not only are there Russian planes providing support for Syrian troops, it's Russian Spetsnaz on the ground spearheading attacks. There are Russian mercenaries also involved. There's a whole variety of different ways in which, bit by bit, the Russians have got sucked deeper in. And the point is, they can't really now claim mission accomplished. They had that moment, they wasted it, right, and they're now stuck. And it's really hard to see how, unless you either get a peace process in Syria or a military victory, neither of which seems imminently likely at all, alas, how the Russians could actually pull out without tremendous loss of face. So they're stuck there. And that exactly means that they're going to be seen as another one of these Christian colonialist forces.
So we have mission creep and we have blowback going on.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, obviously, this is not a Vietnam. This is or anything like that. In terms of the deployment, is still very, very small and bearable, but in terms of the way that what seemed to be a sort of a smart little move to finesse the Americans at first has turned into an open-ended and expensive in political as well as economic terms commitment.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. When this whole thing started back in 2015, the question, and I remember just having discussions about this in Washington, about whether this was a transactional move, essentially something Moscow to get some skin in the game to have something to trade with the West to normalize relations and get rid of sanctions mm-hmm. and have their way in Ukraine, or if it was an aspirational move. If it was Moscow kind of making its move into the Middle East and kind of claiming its stake as a great power. And it seems this change of decision was from a transactional model to an aspirational model. In the process, though, they appear to be becoming the enemies of Sunni Muslim, a lot of Sunni Muslims.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, this is, I mean, the only sort of quibble I would have is whether they have yet replaced America as the foremost one. No, this is absolutely the risk. And therefore, given that nowadays we are in an age in which actually terrorism, as much as anything else, is a phenomenon, a movement, an ideology, more than structures and organizations. Mm-hmm. I mean, if one looks, you know, if we're looking for harbingers, I mean, the Karlov case, there's no evidence that someone at some kind of fictional terrorist central said, activate our agent in the Turkish police to kill him. No, it was individuals who think, right, this is the way I can strike back. And I think this is the real danger, and this is what we face in the West as well. But particularly for Russia, it's going to be a challenge because, this coming year, we're probably going to see an increasing backflow of Russian, Central Asian, North Caucasus fighters from Islamic State who actually will be going back and bringing with them this ideology of jihad into Russia.
Right, so this is something that could strike Russia at
exactly.
home
it's
as
well as
abroad.
It's not just about, you know, individual. I mean, yes, absolutely. It means that Russian, everything from tourists to ambassadors to companies, could be at threat around the world, as the Americans have discovered to their cost. But it's also something that could well be visited at home.
Now, let's broaden this out a little bit beyond Syria and the Middle East. Russia also has had a pretty good year vis-a-vis Europe. As you've pointed out numerous times, they didn't create the migrant crisis. They didn't create the rise of populism and xenophobia, but they're certainly capitalizing on it. They're certainly cheerleading it. They're certainly aiding and abetting it. No, they didn't cause Brexit, but between 1 and 2 percentage point win, any little bit helps, mm-hmm. and Russia certainly did its best to help. So what do you think of the possibility for blowback there? I know you touched on this in your piece. And
they regard the European Union as a normative challenge, in that it represents a very, very different kind of union from the sort of rather coercive empire, in effect, that Moscow is currently building in its near abroad. And also, it stands for a whole series of values which are pretty antithetical to this kleptocratic authoritarianism mm-hmm. we call Russia. But at the same time, I mean, let's be perfectly honest, the European Union is in many ways a phenomenally dysfunctional actor on the global stage, certainly in terms of the things that Moscow cares about. Moscow doesn't care about harmonized customs regimes and where roads get built. Moscow cares precisely about how groups assert their power abroad. And the European Union is not, you know, it is, as it were, to sort of flip things around. It tend to punch below its weight internationally.
Although it's been getting much better.
It's getting better. I mean, look, I don't want to knock it generally. And particularly, I think Federica Mogherini has been making some real progress in terms of identifying a sort of some kind of plausible security strategy that isn't either ridiculously aspirational or totally non-consequential. But nonetheless, this is the process, and it's a long-term process, and particularly given the current problems of the EU, who knows if it's actually going to become that meaningful. So, at the one hand, you have Russia that sees European Union as a problem and is happy to exacerbate all the various tensions and pressures within it. What I think Moscow may not fully appreciate is the extent to which the European Union, which after all is absolutely and inextricably connected to this quest for harmony and dialogue, is also, I would say, a restraining force on a variety of actors. And, you know, I think for me the classic example would be Poland. Poland, a country that clearly regards Russia as a clear and present threat, especially under the current government, that has evident aspirations to be the sort of, you know, a regional power, the Germany, shall I say, of Central Europe, and could actually be a lot more inconvenient for Moscow. I mean, there's a lot of talk within Poland about, for example, how they could provide much more active support for Ukraine in its struggle against Russia. It doesn't, and in part that's because precisely the European Union tends to sort of damp down potentially inflammatory actions by individual member states. Likewise, France or Germany, the assumption is that a sort of a change in regime will mean a more Putin-friendly one. Well, it might in the short term. But actually, you know, either France or Germany could be much more problematic for Russia. In general terms, the more Russia creates a zero-sum, dog-eat-dog, call it what you will, in order internationally or within Europe, the more actually it will be creating countries that could well be much, much more, well, just generally, shall I say, exactly, problematic for Russia, which we have to realise that Russia, after all, is a weak country. It relies on the restraint of others, and the EU is more than anything else a force for restraint.
But that said, you would think, I mean, yes, these countries are, Poland aspires to be a regional power. Poland one-on-one with Russia is really no match for Russia militarily. Or even economically.
But the interesting thing is that even while the EU is under strain, NATO, frankly, is not, or certainly the countries that, as it were, matter to the core of NATO power. We're not talking about military algorithms here. I mean, this is not a question about wars. If nothing else, look, Poland is not a nuclear power.
Right.
But if we're talking about just simply, well, thinking, well, we can put a few million zloty into, you know, this particular organization supporting this particular person. If Poland or, and I'm picking on Poland and it's unfair to do so, but, or, you know, if a country or even a small group of countries wanted to think in terms of what could we do to actually strike back and in some ways play Russia at its own game. Actually, Russia is tremendously vulnerable to the very same tactics in many ways that it employs, you know, in an asymmetric way. Maybe this would even bring up sort of talks of the so-called Intermarium.
Well, yeah, I was going to say this.
You know, a block from the Baltics.
From the Baltics through Poland, yeah.
You know, all of these come back onto the table, frankly, if the European Union begins to either fall apart or just simply become irrelevant.
Now, I think what you're saying is very true in the long term, but what I'm pretty worried about is the short term and the medium term. Look, we've got Brexit's already happened. France holds presidential elections in the spring, May and June, in which it's going to be probably the second round is going to be one pro-Moscow candidate, Marine Le Pen, against another pro-Moscow candidate, François Fillon. So Moscow wins there already.
Well,
if it's Le Pen, it could be the end of the EU, no?
First of all, caveat, when we say pro-Moscow, we're talking probably anti-American, anti-EU, anti-sanctions.
Fillon's not anti-EU, but he's anti-sanctions.
No, but he's anti-sanctions. That's what we're talking. But you know, we're not actually talking about Siberian candidates. We're not talking about people who really love
Russia. No, but we're talking about, when we're talking about Fillon, we're talking about somebody that does want to normalize relations with Russia, that does want to end the sanctions regime, that probably wouldn't be too bothered by Moscow having its way in the former Soviet space, which we're going to get to in a bit. We got elections in the Netherlands coming up in March, and then the big enchilada with Germany at the end of the year. And this week's terrorist attack in Berlin, again, is raising questions about Angela Merkel's viability. So you, in the short run, I can easily see, if not a fractured European Union or a destroyed European Union, one that is going to be much less firm on questions of sanctions, much less firm on standing up to Russia in the former Soviet space, which is what Russia really cares about, let's face it. We're going to see a Europe that's much more willing to do the kind of business deals that Moscow wants to penetrate its corrupt form of capitalism into Russia, into Europe, I'm sorry. So in the short term, even if these things are going to be dangerous for Russia in the long term, in the short term, they can get a lot of what they want and they can do a lot of damage, no?
Well, let's say, okay, let's assume that happens, this whole sort of particular sequence of dominoes falls that way. Yeah, absolutely. At this point, the European Union would be likely much, much less effective because precisely it'll get sort of snarled up in all kinds of debates as to whether it should be and what kind of union it should be and everything else. And sanctions, well, let me be perfectly honest. I mean, to a large extent, the first decision about sanctions will be coming from Washington, D.C., rather than Europe. You know, if America goes that way, then Europe is not going to hold on to the sanctions regime in any meaningful sense. I mean, sure, some personal sanctions may be for symbolic, but basically speaking, where America goes, in this respect, Europe leads. Now, that doesn't mean that even if America sticks with it, that Europe wouldn't start to defect too. But the impact of sanctions is not that great. It won't actually lead to any quick and sort of dramatic improvement in the situation within Russia. And more broadly, yes, of course, it'll mean that maybe Russia could therefore sort of move more money in or whatever. But frankly, at the moment, it is disgracefully easy for it in most countries to do that anyway. I mean, the very fact that we're having this conversation is in part because, exactly, Russians already have been funding political campaigns, political parties, penetrating strategic and economic sectors and such like.
As the Atlantic Council showed in their recent report, they do it in a very stealthy way in Great Britain, which does not violate British law.
Sure. Certainly. So, okay, maybe they'll be able to do it easily, or more easily, rather. But that does not represent a shift change, in my opinion. I mean, I think we need to worry about the long term. I mean, obviously, as an EU citizen so far, I am exceedingly concerned about the future of the EU. But when we actually, in terms of the EU vis-a-vis Russia, yes, we probably will see an EU that is less bullish about standing up to Russia in its imperial sort of aspirations. But quite frankly, the European Union in and of itself has not been that powerful a force anyway.
Although it's been the biggest surprise since the Ukraine crisis broke, one of the biggest surprises, the cohesiveness of Europe on sanctions and on this policy. Surprised the hell out of the Kremlin.
Yeah, absolutely. And in some ways, ironically enough, although it's obviously a great pain for policymakers, having this sort of six-month cycle of having to reaffirm the sanctions actually also means that every 6 months the Kremlin gets reminded of the resolution of Europe. So in some ways, I think that there has been a sort of perverse positive aspect.
And
that.
They just renewed them again.
Yeah, exactly.
Through July.
So no, that's perfectly true. But again, I think we need to keep this in context. I mean, if Europe does not renew the sanctions, and especially if this is done in harmony with Washington, yes, that will be a very bad move. I absolutely agree in terms of the symbolism. But in terms of the practical impact, it's hard to think at the moment of anything that Russia seriously seems to want to do that it is currently held back from doing so because of the fear of sanctions.
Maybe go deeper into Ukraine. I mean, I wonder if there weren't sanctions, would they be in Mariupol already?
I hardly think that. I mean, compared with actually the boots on the ground factor, the fact that actually if there is a success story about Ukraine, it's about just how effectively they have managed to reform and rebuild their army, which means that, in fact, I think that any substantial additional military incursion, unless Russia is really willing to go all in, which again would have massive economic as well as political implications for itself, I think the days of thinking of further serious Russian incursions, I think, are gone. Yes, we're going to continue to see bloody skirmishes as we have just now. But I think a major push, it is not because they're worried about what the European Union is going to say, that there are not Russian troops in Mariupol.
Although they might be worried about further sanctions, a swift ban. I mean, in a different international environment, when you had different people in power, when you didn't have a Brexit and you didn't.
But we do have a Brexit. I mean, the point is, here we have a situation in which there is, Trump is busy sort of polishing his silverware, ready to move into the White House. We have Brexit, and it means Brexit, whatever that may mean. We already have a situation in which actually the West is not, it's fair to say, all racked up and ready to roll. And there is no signs of the Russians looking seriously to push forward in any of the sort of the obvious battlefronts.
Mm. Now let's broaden out to the international system. I want to come back to the U.S. separately, but let's broaden it out to the international system now, because one of the things Putin says he wanted, and he seems closer to it now than ever before, is a revisal of the post-Cold War international order, which is a polite way of saying he wants to have his way in the former Soviet space. He wants to have imperial dominance over his neighbors. He seems closer to that than ever right now. Because if we have a fractured Europe, we have a U.S. that's not interested in confrontation with Moscow, pretty much we'll give him a free hand. No, he's gonna reach this goal, or he appears close to reaching this goal.
Scarily enough, he does. And that is certainly not a good thing for the world. I mean, although there's a whole variety of qualms one could express about the current global system, and in fact a lot of countries such as China already are, nonetheless, just sweeping it away without anything similar in place is definitely not a particularly sort of good vista. But again, I think the important thing to realise is the extent to which, however little he may be willing to acknowledge this, Putin has actually been the beneficiary of that system. This is a weak country which has been able to play these guerrilla geopolitical games precisely because of the restraint of others, because other people follow the rules. Now, if he really wants to sweep away those rules, well, actually, I'm not so sure that if I was bordering China, a rising China, I would be quite so keen about the notion that sovereignty is simply about what you can enforce. You know, generally speaking, I mean, you know, I know we're going to be talking about the America in a moment, but, you know, actually, the kind of capabilities that America has got, military, political, economic, soft power, cyber, you name it, if a regime in Washington actually wanted to really cause trouble for Russia, I mean, it really could do so on a dramatic level. It doesn't, because that's not the way the current system works.
And my understanding is the U.S. intelligence community very much was gearing up to do this in the aftermath of the elections if the elections had resulted in a different result.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, look, there is no question but that Hillary Clinton would have been one to stick to the existing pattern. Yes, of course, there might well have been some kind of response to Russian interference. But no, I mean, I'm talking about truly huge implications for Russia, that actually if you had a government in Washington that really didn't care, didn't feel it had to worry about proving sort of casus belli, proving that it actually was responding proportionately, and obviously without turning into the realms of thermonuclear mayhem, but nonetheless, actually, if a country such as the United States was willing to play by the kind of rules that Putin currently uses, my God, Russia would be in a dangerous position. So I think this is the thing. I mean, actually, Putin has, however much he has set himself against the international system, in many ways, one of his key assets has been his capacity to use that.
So Putin can only be Putin in this international system.
Yeah.
A new international system would be filled with Putins.
Exactly. And you know, frankly,
Putin's with a lot more capacity
than
the actual
Putin.
Putin
in Beijing would be a lot more scary.
A Putinized Beijing, mm-hmm. or a Putinized Germany, or a Putinized yeah. United States, right? Let's talk about the United States, actually. Now, this is one we've been over, and we've talked about this quite a bit, the potential for blowback there. You've made the point that I completely agree with, that Trump is going to be unpredictable and be Putin's Putin. Mm-hmm. And this is dangerous, so Putin will not be able to play the games with the U.S. he's been able to play. Does he care? Because maybe he's not going to want to play. If the U.S., I mean, how do you see this playing out? It looks like, I mean, pending confirmation by the Senate, Rex Tillerson is going to be the Secretary of State. You have Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor. We certainly are going to see a White House that is much more Moscow-friendly than we've seen.
Sure. And look, when it comes down to it, we are all guessing. And mm-hmm. to be honest, I'm sure most members in the incoming presidential team are just guessing quite what policy they're going to be asked to implement once they're there. And I certainly feel that, I mean, we've always had this pattern, or not always, but of late we've had this pattern that a new president is always a honeymoon period with Russia. Now, it's going to be a very, very different kind of honeymoon period.
Yes.
And it may well be rather longer and much more kind of business oriented. And I absolutely agree that I think in the first instance, we're going to see, you know, far, far, not just warmer discussions and things, but actually, you know, probably, well, sadly, I think probably some kind of pressure on sanctions regime and such mm-hmm. like. But when it comes down to it, look, successive presidencies have been very Anglophile. And yet, in practical terms, the special relationship between Britain and America has been dying. There's no question about that. I mean, when it comes down to it, practicalities in the long term will almost always trump sentimentalities, if you can excuse the expression. Now, you know, it may well be that there are particular business interests, for example, in the oil sector, yeah. just to pick a random sector.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when it comes down to it, though, I mean, I think the question will be, look, if Putin wants to improve relations with a Trump White House, then he needs to be able to make deals. That, I think it's fair to say, is going to be the, you know, underlying leitmotif of the Trump presidency. It will be the art of the deal presidency. Now, that's fine. So, in a way, he can rely to an extent, at first in particular, on just simply the fact that this is an administration that probably cares so much less about issues such as Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. And therefore, they might be there, well, why are we bothering giving money to the Ukrainians? Or why are we bothering maintaining sanctions over Donbass or whatever? Okay. But in the longer term, Putin has to have something that he can offer. So either he makes deals, which means that he has to bring stuff to the table, or he continues to basically just try and push and see what he can get for free, and he might well find that actually this is a much, much more hard-nosed American administration than past ones in that respect. Now, okay, this is just guessing.
That's the positive outlook. That, the negative that one, is. What's the alternative, though? Because I think that is possible. Yeah. But I think just as possible, if not more likely, is another variant where basically this administration could just not be interested in what Russia's doing in its patch of the world.
True. But again, we have to ask ourselves
what
how much kind of Western and U.S. concern really has acted as a constraining factor on Putin. I would suggest that yes, I mean, we absolutely have to, you know, demonstrate our commitment to our values and things. But actually, I mean, on the whole, the sanctions regime has not been a particularly powerful force.
See, I would argue it's been more powerful than it's been given credit for, actually. I actually think West has gotten quite good at sanctions, and they've gotten quite good at targeting sanctions. And the fact that Moscow wants them lifted and is expending effort to get them lifted suggests to me that they are harming the economy. They are harming the pocketbooks of, I mean, we can definitely go a lot farther. Edward Lucas made some bold suggestions in a piece in the Times mm-hmm. yesterday along these lines. But I think we've gotten much better at this. And they appear to be, they're not the only factor harming the Russian economy, but they're certainly not helping.
They're not helping. And they certainly, I think more than anything else, actually make it harder for the Russian economy to pull itself out of its recession. I think it's at the back
denying
end.
Denying access to credits. I mean, that's huge.
But this, I mean, kind of huge. It's also actually, you know, there are unfortunately too many ways around it as well. But yes, it creates additional kind of frictional cost.
But this is now what we're going to see is a changing of the trajectory. Because if the trend were to keep sanctions because of who is in power in the U.S. and in Europe, we would have been thinking about plugging those holes.
Yeah.
Right? We're not going to be thinking about plugging those holes. We're going to be thinking about removing those plugs, if I could continue that silly metaphor.
Yeah, I mean, okay, look, again, if we want to paint the worst case scenario, I mean, there's no way of getting around it. It will mean an America that is essentially disengaged, that won't care about what Russia does domestically. And we've got to not forget that a lot of the Russian concern is also about the, you know, basically don't interfere with what we do at home, but also within its near abroad. We'll probably see sanctions lifted or at least dramatically reduced. Maybe the Donbass ones lifted, the Crimean ones remaining or similar, which obviously will help the Russian economy. But as much as anything else, I don't think this is about just straightforward raw economic cost. I think it's actually that the sanctions regime needs to be lifted in Putin's perspective because it represents an embarrassment, because it represents something that is actually saying that Russia is beyond the pale and sort of strangely and especially
bad. It demonstrates that the West has the ability to punish.
Yeah, Russia, I mean, which is not what a great power should. Exactly. I mean, this is his notion of sovereignty, is Russian sovereignty. In other words, no one should be able to do anything to us.
Right.
So I think there's all kinds of reasons why he would want sanctions lifted, even if they're not, as I said, we can discuss exactly the impact on the economy, but clearly compared with oil prices, it's not the determining thing. So, okay, so we could well see an America that just doesn't really care. A Europe that might care and might not care, but isn't really in a position to do anything about it.
Divided and doesn't speak
precisely.
With one voice.
But then again, you have to ask, okay, so what does this mean that Putin is likely to do that he can't or won't do at the moment? Where might he want to intervene and what will be the consequences? And actually, that's where it begins to get a bit harder to really sort of play out some long-term thing. Now, I'm not saying, oh, we should just sit back and everything's going
to
be
3 years ago, I wouldn't imagine that he wanted to invade Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Sure.
Really? Would you have? And 10 years ago, I would have said, oh, an invasion of Georgia, that's ridiculous. That's not going to happen. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, we can't have
True,
a failure of imagination
we,
now.
We have to look also at the question of resources, though.
If he thought he could, I think he would invade the Baltics.
Why?
If he thought he could. If there wasn't a NATO or if they, at this point.
For what purpose? What are the Baltics got that he wants?
To protect the Russian population there.
He doesn't
there.
Care about
I
the
I know
Russians.
He doesn't care, but he wants the movie about it to be shown on Russian television.
Look, he can get whatever movie he wants without needing to actually invade countries, and especially countries where, you know, at least a substantial proportion of the population are going to be bloody-mindedly resistant and armed resistant about it. No, I mean, I think when we come down to it, I mean, I think Georgia was one thing, Ukraine was one thing. The Baltic states, I think they've accepted, were never really Nash and certainly are not Nash.
I'm not sure about that. I hope you're right. But I'm not sure for the sake of the Baltics, and as somebody who has a very big soft spot for all three of those countries, I hope you're right. But I'm not sure you're right, and we don't know because we're speculating.
But on the other hand, I mean, but that said, I mean, I think we do need to come back to this point that one of the interesting things is that, I mean, although obviously Trump has made his comments about allies that don't really pull their weight and so forth, but nonetheless, actually.
The Baltics are pulling their weight.
The Baltics are certainly pulling their weight, and the Poles, likewise, they're already
the
putting more than 2% in.
The countries that are threatened are pulling their weight.
But the point is that NATO is actually in a much, much better position than the European Union. And if you look at NATO countries, I mean, there's a whole variety of reasons to actually say in some ways, not every way, but in some ways it's actually stronger than it's been for a long time.
This was my feeling from, you know, starting with the Wales summit and continuing to the Warsaw summit. I walked out of Warsaw this summer at the summit saying, wow, I've never seen this. It's a whole new NATO. Right. But we've yet to see what NATO is going to look like with the new administration in, because the American factor in NATO it's quite an understatement to say it's huge.
Of course.
Right. And we don't know what NATO is going to look like under a Trump presidency. We don't know what the American position in NATO is going to be. Under every other American president, be it Bush, Clinton, Obama, it didn't matter. The American position was what it was, and everybody knew what to expect from the United States in NATO. Now there's probably some uncertainty about that. No?
There's uncertainty, but I think we shouldn't underestimate the impact of Congress and the Pentagon. In actually sort of, if need be, maintaining quite a strong rearguard action against any kind of serious disengagement. Secondly, actually, I mean, again, let me continue in my role as optimist in chief. look, if it makes
Europe...
Can
I take whatever drugs you're taking? can you sell me some?
At the moment, unfortunately, it's cold medication. Look, it is essentially about the fact that this could make Europe a lot more serious about its own defence, which actually is no bad thing. And the interesting thing is, if we now look, there is definitely a drive towards increasing defence expenditures within Europe. More countries than ever are actually sort of ramping them up. It'll be a way before most of them
get
to
2%.
But nonetheless, I mean, it says something that actually they are moving towards increasing their spend. We have, on the one hand, Europe that is getting more serious, and that doesn't mean necessarily the European Union. I do have some qualms at the potential tensions when people talk about sort of European Union military. But nonetheless, you know, the bottom line is that unless Trump is actually willing to want to say, we're pulling out of NATO, anything short of that, and I think NATO is actually fairly sort of solid, because actually, you know, if one looks at it, we have the new multinational battalions being deployed in the Baltics and Poland. Excellent, useful step forward. We have much more attention being played on to hybrid warfare and basically non-traditional combat strategies. We have, as I said, more money being spent. We have a continued demonstration of commitment with things like Baltic air patrolling, that actually countries which don't have any reason to feel threatened themselves, the Italians, the Spaniards, and so mm-hmm. forth, you know, are willing to send, and obviously spend money, sending their planes to patrol Baltic airspace, which is one, I think, a very important commitment, and one that I was actually a bit worried about, whether or not we were going to see some wobble this year. Mm-hmm. And we didn't, so full credit to them. So, I mean, I think actually, and we actually have the fact of, you know, Sweden and Finland contemplating joining. We actually have one new member, you know, a minor detail of an attempted coup, but, you know, sort of shoring up sort of the presence in the Balkans or whatever. You know, actually, NATO, I think, has weathered this year much better than I would have feared 12 months ago.
I agree, but I am fearful for the future. And I'll tell you one of my nightmare scenarios is that at some point, if we have an American disengagement, it doesn't mean leaving NATO, but a disengagement in a situation where Europe's much more responsible for its own defense. On continental Europe, that's going to mean basically somebody stepping in and filling in the American role in underwriting the military security of the continent. And who's that going to be? Well, it's going to be Germany. Germany's going to be faced with a choice. Either you become the new America in Europe and underwrite Europe's security, or you make a deal with Putin. Now, I think I know how Angela Merkel would choose there, but I'm not sure how one of her successors would choose.
Okay, tell me what that deal would be. Give me a shape of that deal.
the shape of that deal is Russia stops messing around in Europe. We give them a free hand in Ukraine in the former Soviet space. That's one possible contour of the deal.
I mean, in some ways, the interesting thing is that on one level, we sound as if we're talking about very different futures. On another level, I think there's actually one point, when it comes down to it, I think we agree. Look, the sad truth of the matter is, for the moment, I think that Ukraine, that Georgia, that Moldova, that Belarus are on their own. I mean, I think, unfortunately, that is already...
The case?
The case, pretty much. Well, I mean, it's the case for what I think 2017 will hold. And in some ways, whether or not the European Union holds or gets further wobbly, whatever Trump is, I think it's very, very unlikely that Trump is going to suddenly discover that he's actually passionate about Ukrainian sovereignty. Regardless of who wins the French, the Dutch, the German, potentially the Italian elections, basically the European Union is not going to be... I mean, yes, they will say the right things, but it's not really going to be willing to put much muscle behind it. The question is, okay, will the sanctions regime remain as it is, or will it actually waste away? But either way, I really don't think that there's going to be much credibility that the West, except in perhaps nightmare scenarios, if, you know, God forbid, and I don't think it would happen for a moment, but if, you know, Kiev became the next Aleppo, as there are some lunatics in Moscow who are sort of advocating. But I really don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, barring something like that, I really think that certainly for the moment, the West has already disengaged or is moving in a disengaging direction. And even Angela Merkel, who has become this sort of, you know, the new sainted icon of Europe.
The West's last best hope.
But, I mean, she is going to have to be devoting her resources to domestic issues and European issues rather than wider issues.
So let's pivot to the former Soviet space. It looks like this is the one area where it does unambiguously look like Russia is winning and is poised to win. Or is there a potential for blowback there too?
Well, I think, let me put it this way, Russia has a free hand. Now, whether that means winning is another matter. I mean, in a way, so what can it do, for example, with Ukraine? I mean, it's actually very hard to see any kind of possible deal being struck, the way things are currently configured. Now, I mean, it's interesting, having just come back from Kiev, and there's a lot of people wondering how long Poroshenko is going to last, or is actually even going to want to stay in power, let's face it. The joy of wearing a military uniform wears off after a while. But, you know, and I suppose maybe if we had a return of Tymoshenko, then there might be some kind of deal. But even then, I mean, look, what would this deal be? Yes, it might be, look, we'll accept that we're not going to join, you know, not even think about joining NATO or the European Union or whatever. Well, apart from the fact that all such deals last until they're reneged upon. They're actually only really recognizing reality, because not as if Ukraine in the foreseeable future is going to become a member of either of these structures. And frankly, could Kiev cope with the Donbass if it was returned to it at the moment? Very questionable. So it's not that I don't think that Russia will actually have the capacity to do a lot of harm. The question is, what can it do that will actually advance its own cause? And if so, if we're talking about blowback, if you're going to say to Kiev, no, you're back in the empire, mate, like it or not,
right.
You know, the West has turned its back on you, you're stuck with us, mate. Well, empire is about more than just coercion. I mean, actually, in that respect, I mean, empires become phenomenal drains upon metropolitan states. In the same way as actually, if you're looking at Syria, if it looks once upon a time the Afghanistan for the Soviet Union. Well, okay, in that case, frankly, the Russians are going to be having to provide some kind of goodies for Kiev. And it might well be that they're going to have to spend more money on the Donbass in order to put it into decent shape for Ukraine to be able to reincorporate it, rather than just simply dumping it on as a hugely toxic and destabilizing influence on the country. I mean, I think this is it. Putin wants empire because it's what great powers have.
Or what he thinks great powers have.
Yeah, exactly.
Have.
But, you know, in his note, again, going back to this 19th century notion,
right.
That, you know, great powers
his 1914 brain, or 1814 brain. Precisely. Yeah, that's what great powers have.
But when you actually look at, well, what would this really mean in reality? And clearly this is not the kind of question that anyone is asking Putin. What would this actually mean for Russia in reality? I mean, I think it's actually fairly clear that these become costs, not assets. But what would almost certainly happen is, regardless, the Donbass is going to continue in its current state and it will continue to be the unacknowledged oblast receiving all of its funds, really, out of Russian federal treasury.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, maybe he can bring more pressure to bear on Georgia, which is already in a slightly sort of wobbly state.
Mm-hmm.
But in the grand scheme of things, this will make him feel good. This might make him feel that he's earning one more paragraph in the history books about Vladimir the Greater, the regatherer of the Russian and a bit of other people's lands. But in practical terms, actually, it is going to just simply drag further down the Russian economy. And also, I think it's fair to say, identify Russia more and more clearly as the aggressor state.
I've been playing this kind of intellectual game with myself, this thought exercise. History doesn't repeat itself, and it's debatable whether or not it rhymes. But I used to think we were going through a replay of the 70s to a degree, a period where the West was in a temporary funk. The Soviet Union was ascendant and seemed to be on the march. But over time, the fundamentals of both systems took over, and the West emerged victorious. We remember how that movie ended. That was my positive, optimistic scenario. There's another scenario, and it's something I touched on the Daily Vertical this week, and that's that maybe we're headed through the 1930s. Which of these do you think, before we move on to the second half and to have the delightful task of talking about Putin's scintillatingly interesting press conference, which of these two do you think is more likely, or if any?
I mean, if I was going to have to pick one, I'd be saying the 1970s.
Yeah.
And, you know, we really can't, I mean, although I sort of scarcely remember it, I'm not quite that old, but yeah, I mean.
I remember it very well.
But I remember 1979. When the Soviets rolled into Afghanistan. And the coverage at the time, it was all precisely kind of Empire Strikes Back. It was, this is the first step on the way to India.
Pakistan, India, yeah.
It was all about basically, you see, the Soviets can do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing the West can do about it. At the time...
It looked that way.
Absolutely.
I was 16 years old. I remember it looked that way.
This is a war that's going to cost 15,000 Soviet lives. This is a war that is also going to sort of lead to, contribute to a massive delegitimization of the state. It's not the war that brought down the Soviet Union. It's not even the Soviet Vietnam. But nonetheless, actually, what we interpreted at the time as an act of successful, cunning aggression, little brown men, actually, at the was motivated, as we now know, by near enough terror in the Politburo. A sense that basically the world was going against them, and a sense that they actually had to intervene to prop up a regime that they didn't even really like or respect, but because otherwise they felt it was going to swing to the Americans' way. And they just felt, well, if we let that happen, then actually our empire falls apart. It's quite interesting the extent to which the world as viewed from inside the Kremlin was so different from our mm-hmm. world. Now, okay, again, different times, different situations, but when it comes down to it, look, the depressing truth about politics is that it's pretty much always about economics. And since none of us really understand economics, and it's also
none of us understand politics,
and it's dumb.
I'm out of a job.
Well, but politics is fun. It's about people. It's not about impersonal forces or whatever. So we concentrate on that. But, when one actually looks at the economic fundamentals, even with the Great Recession and so forth, the West is strong. China is still pretty strong, even though there's a bit of wobbles. Russia is pretty weak, and likely, actually, it's going to get weaker yet. And that is really, I think, going to be sort of the crucial factor. There's temptations to look at it in sort of the 30s mould with the rise of populism. But, even so, modern populism is not, I think... even faintly heading towards gas chambers.
Well, you don't have to have that for it to be the 30s. I mean, but what I mean by the 30s is not an exact repeat of the 30s,
sure,
but a period of total war, possibly, or of the rise of authoritarian regimes in different key large states.
There are populist and authoritarian leaders, but most of these states actually have quite strong institutions that I think will prove more. I mean, again, maybe I'm
we keep here coming back to that, and I want to believe that. I was raised that our institutions are so strong, and they're what make our country, not people. But institutions are, at the end of the day, only as strong as the people in those institutions. Look what's happening in Poland right now. Are Poland's institutions stopping the slide towards authoritarianism? To a degree.
To a degree, as indeed is Polish
grassroots civil society
and popular opinion. But also, I mean, you know, Poland, as with all of the other post-Warsaw Pact states, you know, it's actually much, much less deeply rooted. It's a difference if you're talking about the United States or Britain or Germany or France.
I hope you're right. I've thought for the end of the year, and it's a good moment to shift gears since we've gone longer than I expected. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at Vladimir Putin's big end-of-year press conference. What were the big takeaways? What message was the Kremlin leader trying to send? I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Мы говорим, что мы просто сильнее любого агрессора. Это так. Там не знаю, кто бы там перевернулся в гробу. Рейган бы, мне кажется, порадовался, что представители его партии побеждают. Мы оружие экспортируем на 14,5 миллиардов долларов. Рост производительности труда просто взрывной, выведенный из Алеппо. Крупнейшая международная гуманитарная акция. Хорошо было бы добиться того, чтобы на Донбассе украинскую армию не считали оккупантами. Без нашего участия, без участия России, это было бы просто невозможно.
And it wouldn't be the holiday season without Vladimir Putin's big end-of-year press conference. For me, this year's big press conference, as the Kremlin likes to call it, Bolshaya Press Conference, with all the Super Bowl-like build-up, it was marked by what was absent. There wasn't the trademark salty language and references to body parts. You didn't have the quips that are usually associated with this. You didn't have the surprise question by an opposition journalist. Remember in the past, Ksenia Sobchak would ask a quote-unquote surprise question. You didn't have a single question about Alexei Navalny's potential presidential bid through the entire press conference. Putin pretty much stuck to his standard talking points. It was pretty dull. Now, there were a couple of things that certainly caught my attention. Criticism of the United States was muted, but criticism of the Democratic Party certainly was not. Putin was clearly well briefed about how to couch this. He asked about the hackers, for example. He said, well, we really don't know who did this. But, you know, as a result of their actions, the Americans learned of the dirty machinations inside of the Democratic Party. And as a result, Democratic National Committee Chairman Debbie Wasserman Schultz had to resign. Who the hell knew that Putin knew who Debbie Wasserman Schultz was? But he knew it today, right? And then he closed it off saying, so the hackers did a good job. It was almost like a taunt. In terms of the allegations of Russian interference in the elections, he pointed out that, well, the losers always like to point the finger elsewhere. I would like to point out that the Democrats lost the Congress as well as the presidency. Am I responsible for that, too? Right. So he pointed out, again, obscure fact. I didn't even know it until Putin said it. And then I looked it up, that a record number of electors defected from Hillary Clinton in the Electoral College. Now, the reason they did so is rather complicated and is not indicative of anything. But he pointed that obscure fact out. He didn't miss a chance to hit at the Democrats, but he was very careful not to criticize the United States. He criticized on missile defense, which I think could turn out to be a point of contention between Trump and Putin at some point. But he said, no, Trump's plans for a military buildup don't bother him. So by and large, this just lacked the signature moments that we usually see in these events. What was your takeaway, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was 3 hours and 53 minutes of greatest hits, to a large extent. Yeah, I mean,
it was like a compilation record.
Precisely, it was. Yeah. You know, sort of, Putin can't make it, so we put together this. No, I mean, obviously, as you say, the key distinction is his comments about the United States. I rather loved the fact that not only did he say that the American electoral system was archaic and unfair, but he also said that Trump voters are people who share our traditional values.
Yes, he did say that.
Again, obviously trying to sort of build some bridges.
This was also in response to a question about what he thought about the fact that 37% of Republicans have sympathized with him. Which came out in a poll that was published in Politico, I believe. I read about it in Politico this week anyway. And that, do you think that Ronald Reagan is turning over in his grave? And yeah, it shows that a lot of people are unhappy with the way the world is governed and support our traditional values.
Exactly. And again, obviously, it was interesting that point when you made actually about sort of that Trump, you know, right up to the end, no one believed that he could win except us.
Yeah.
Which is not even true, but that's another matter. Okay, but put that aside, exactly the sort of the trolling of America. And yeah, this was distinctly dry. I mean, Sputnik beforehand had said, expect the unexpected. And in some ways, what turned out to be the unexpected was precisely the lack of anything, even to insert a sort of a little artificial.
But it went on long. This was what was strange about it. If you're going to do a dull press conference, cut it off after an hour and a half, for God's sakes, and give me a chance to go get lunch.
But this was obviously his key concern. But yeah, I mean, we did have, I mean, it was interesting that we had, first of all, a question about early elections, presidential elections. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, it's possible, but inexpedient.
Yeah.
He was asked specifically about sort of whether he would be standing in 2018.
Well, Andrei Kolesnikov, his favorite journalist, asked that.
Precisely.
One.
So, and but again, if you're going to have someone actually primed to ask that question, come up with a better answer than basically, I'll see how things look in 2017 and make that decision. I mean, look, of course he's going to be standing. Yeah. But nonetheless, it's interesting that he's still playing coy.
No question about Navalny.
No. I mean, I think... In some ways, I'm not surprised they would have tried to ensure that there wasn't a question about Navalny. I mean, obviously, you know, you only get to control certain numbers of the journalists. But given that we've just had this statement from Volodin, saying that he doesn't think
that's precisely
why eligible.
This is precisely why I thought Putin.
Yeah, but the point is then, if he had been asked that question, he would have had to have given essentially a definitive answer one way or the other. Either he would have said, I mean, okay, he could have just simply said, well, that's something for the courts or whoever to decide. But even then, he would have been giving it weight and mileage. I think, you know, again, I don't think there was a good answer for him in that particular forum. Interesting, actually, about European Union, just to sort of bring up that. I mean, he says that, you know, we want to have a reliable and strong partner. But he also added, without a third country's involvement.
Yeah,
and again, I think that is definitely, I think, going to be, you know, obviously, this is reprising the point from the first part of the podcast, definitely going to be one of the themes. They're going to continue their efforts to break the transatlantic connection.
Yeah.
And I think so, the sort of the flip side of the attempted charm offensive
and
to America.
And they may have a partner in the White House in that endeavor.
Yeah, exactly. But that, you know, definitely scenting blood on that one. Interestingly, quite in favor of the Ukrainian visa-free deal. But
what did you make of that?
Well, because of what then followed, because he then said, because generally speaking, we think that within Europe, there's a question about, you know, why, you know, basically we should be addressing visa issues within Europe as a whole. In other words, I think the subtext there was
Russia should have
what about food. Russia
right.
visas? You know, so I think,
saw that possible subtext, and I saw the possible subtext of that if you know the maybe thinking that a flood of Ukrainians into Europe would further, you know, whatever.
It could be. I mean, but in a way, that whether it's going to happen is not really down to Putin. I think this is him putting down a marker, thinking actually we want something else. You know, I mean, in European politics, he was actually having to be a little bit more careful. It's interesting that there was a Kurdish journalist who got to ask a question. It was quite interesting there because I was thinking, oh, this is going to be interesting because on the one hand, traditionally, the Russians have been quite favorable to the Kurds exactly as a weapon against the Turks.
Right.
But at the moment, there is a sort of the whole Russo-Turkish love fest. And in fact, again, he very carefully sort of wandered around. He said just generically good things about how Kurds, you know, some of my best friends are Kurds almost, but without actually in any way saying anything that actually could sound as if it was weighing in on the whole Turkish, you know, Kurdish homeland and that kind of thing. So, I mean, I think in some ways we actually had three strands. United States, ha-ha, we won. Trump, we love you. Come and love us back. Europe, a much more careful attempt to avoid the obvious traps, but right. definitely making it clear that they're hoping to basically be able to treat Europe as separate from the United States mm-hmm. and break that link. And domestic politics, mind-numbing tedium. Statistics about coal production and so forth. But on the other hand, you know, even he admitted, look, GDP fell 3.8% this year. And it's only going to fall 1% next year, so it's developing positively.
Yeah,
I mean that actually makes me look positively pessimistic. I mean, he really is clearly trying to sort of challenge an optimist. But on the whole, I felt he had nothing to say domestically.
Now, in terms of the overall kind of vibe, I mean, for me, he was strutting, but he looked bored. He was taking a victory lap, but he looked like he didn't have his heart in it. You know, what do you read into that? Why do you think that was the case?
God, yes. I mean, this is it. The whole back to the psychoanalysis of Putin and so forth. You know, I mean, I agree that we've seen this fairly consistently that these days he doesn't seem to be having much fun.
Mm-hmm.
There doesn't seem to be any great enthusiasm, and in some ways, I almost wonder if actually the absence of the quirky question, you know. Should my husband let me have a dog? Type question.
Right.
In the past, was whether it's because he felt it was like sort of beneath him, or that he just couldn't be bothered to get into that whole realm. I'm honestly not sure because we know this is all kind of carefully choreographed. But I think it's more that he's just stuck with it. I mean, he created these institutions to be the kind of intermediary way in which czar and people can notionally connect. It's like, I mean, obviously the phone-in show is even more dramatically that. You know, as a way of getting around the fact that there is no really meaningful democracy. But even this, he really doesn't seem to be that bothered with. It's essentially he just sticks to press release statistics.
Yeah, no, it's,
and
stuck to
right.
his talking points. It wasn't even that the show, the optics of Putin in command of all. Mm-hmm. It didn't even really look all that convincing this time.
Well, no, I mean particularly because look, you know, yeah, he's always got the numbers, and whether it's because he sort of stays up late looking at flashcards or has a little earpiece or whatever.
I think the latter.
certainly I would. But yeah, I mean, this is it. You actually had this sort of, and there he is on this set with a great sort of blue screen behind with sort of, you know, map of Russia and president and such like. All the trappings of precisely the chief executive in command. And he just seemed to be sort of slightly hunched and slouched and just kind of
his body language suggests that at one point towards the end, he's like, this is never going to end, is it? He clearly wanted to wrap it up. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if Peskov kept it going much longer than he thought. What message do you think the Kremlin was trying to send here?
The day you can get Peskov on as a guest, that'll be a good one.
Yeah.
Look, I'm
sure
you'd
give a real honest answer to that question.
Of course, of course. I think, look, in part, it was precisely because, look, you assume if you're going to basically be talking for near enough 4 hours, you know that for 99.99% of your audience, all they're going to get are the sound bites. So in one way, it's about seeding out certain particular sound bites to certain particular audiences. You know, so for CNN, it's going to be the Trump stuff.
Right.
For Deutsche Welle or France 24, it's going to be more European stuff, et cetera, et cetera.
And they had a German journalist ask a question.
Exactly. But on the other hand, the more general thing, I think, again, this is why it becomes an endurance experience, is to try and demonstrate, again, this is the chief executive who is in charge of the facts and the minutiae.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the trouble is that's a slightly dangerous tactic in many ways. It's dangerous in two ways. It has the obvious advantage of precisely sort of trying to get that sense that, look, don't worry, the man in the Kremlin is on top of everything. You know, he will know the agrarian stats from here, and he will be able to talk convincingly about what to name the bridge, the Kerch Strait Bridge. No topic is something that he's not able to converse about. So that's the sort of the plus side. The downside is that it focuses on his technocratic role rather than his more sacral, symbolic role. And let's face it, if you're really going to try and legitimize yourself in technocratic terms, you better actually have a pretty good narrative. Right. If your technocratic legitimation is we're only going to be shrinking the GDP 1% next year, then you know maybe you need to come up with something more. But the second thing is it gets people bogged down in a lot of this stuff. It gets people thinking much more about the realities of life.
Right.
Whereas the whole thrust of so much else is to actually elevate people's thoughts away from that. Doesn't matter if there's less in the fridge because we're a great nation.
But there wasn't a lot of that.
Exactly.
There wasn't a lot of that at all.
I think it was badly placed. It was trying to kind of restate the technocratic chief executive at a time when that doesn't really work.
Right. And even like, you know, the salty language and the quips, that is also an element of sanctifying Putin. Mm. In a kind of perverse way. But it does when this plays into the Putin myth. And there was none of that.
There was no attempt, as it were, to connect to the Russians on an individual basis. I mean, however bizarre that response he gave to the question about, you know, should my husband let me have a dog, in the sort of the previous right. You know, phone-in thing. Nonetheless, I mean, that was a human level question with a human level response. The thing that we found here is these were all. I mean, okay, this is a different function, it's a, you know, press conference, but nonetheless, you know, it was all very top down, big picture, and dull. And there's nothing there, I think, that actually sort of makes him a human being and makes him connect to Russians on a human level.
Did you get the impression from this, because I certainly did not, that he's entering the next year with confidence?
It certainly didn't convey it. I mean, okay, I mean, you know, to an extent.
I mean, he was strutting, but it almost looked forced.
But it was a different kind of strutting. It was not so much. I mean, yeah, there was a certain sort of implied smirk at times when he was talking about the Americans.
Particularly
situation.
When he was talking about the Americans.
Yeah. But, you know, apart from that, actually, there was strikingly little strut. I mean, there was maybe positive statistics being said, but no, I felt there wasn't much of that kind of bravado that we've seen in the past. Okay, I mean, it was slightly, perhaps my perspective is slightly coloured by the fact that certainly at a certain point I was looking for ways of sliding a sharpened HB pencil into my veins rather than actually continue to be watching this thing. But nonetheless, you know, when it comes down to it, he did not. If he does feel, I mean, I'm sure he feels confident in the sense of, you know, if he's going to stand for the election, he's going to win it.
Right.
I think he can be fair.
No, but on the big questions we were talking about in the first half, for example.
If he does feel confident, he certainly was not conveying that. He was doing a bad job of conveying it.
So it's almost as if he had heard our recording in the first half before we recorded it. Perhaps he did.
I'm sure.
And maybe that's a good way to wrap up 2016. That is all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Eliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the enlightening discussion and happy holidays.
Thanks very much. Looking forward to next year.
Me too. And I'd also like to thank our producers, Jan Kaiser and Andreas Kutsina, who are ably filling in for the vacationing Tanya Kancheva. I'd also like to thank my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical will take a 2-week break for the holiday season, but we'll be back in action on January 13th, which, by the way, is Friday the 13th. And until 2017, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.